Good morning. I'm Howard Husick, Vice President for Policy Research at the Manhattan Institute. Welcome to the conference of the Institute's Center for Energy Policy and the Environment entitled Overcoming Obstacles to a National Electricity Grid. Allow me to start our program this morning with a riddle. Can you name a policy that President Obama and Newt Gingrich both endorse? Here's a hint. It's the same one that's also backed by the environmentalist Robert Kennedy Jr. and by Michael Hayek of the utility American Electric Power, and by the leading historian of the American Interstate Highway System, Dan McNichol, and Al Gore, no fan, last I checked, of the automobiles that travel the interstate highway system. Yet each member of this disparate bipartisan group has expressed public support for the idea of improving and extending America's electricity grid. President Obama has put it this way: a newer, smarter electric grid will make our energy bills lower, make outages less likely, and make it easier to use clean energy. Former Speaker Gingrich chose a different tack and a bit of a different tone, as is his wont. "You've got to rebuild the electric grid," he said, "because, as I keep telling all my left-wing environmental friends, if you want people to drive electric cars, there has to be electricity." And yet, despite this apparent consensus, over the course of the past decade, I learned from Mark Robinson, who's on our program this morning, even as we have built 15,000 miles of new interstate natural gas pipelines, we have added just 685 miles of new high-voltage interstate electric power transmission lines. Our conference today will examine why that's so and what we can do about it. Peter Huber, senior fellow in our Center for Energy Policy and the Environment, first made the case for such a national electricity grid almost exactly 2 years ago in an event in this same building. Today, we gather again with Peter, to consider what might be described as how we get there from here. How do we take the steps required to realize our grid goals? Keep in mind that the National Electricity Policy Act of 2005 was intended to jumpstart the high-voltage grid interconnections. But, as I've noted, progress has been painfully slow. In today's program, we'll consider two central aspects of how we might speed it up. First, how to finance the construction of an expanded grid, and second, how to overcome regulatory and political barriers which impede the approval of the siting of the high-voltage lines which form the backbone of a true national grid. In our program this morning, Peter Huber will begin. Peter is the senior fellow at the Institute, co-author with Mark Mills of The Bottomless Well, The Twilight of Fuel, The Virtue of Waste, and Why We'll Never Run Out of Energy. He'll provide a broad framework to get us started, how an improved and interconnected grid relates to our capacity to meet our growing demand for power. Next, Professor Gilbert Metcalf of Tufts University and the National Bureau of Economic Research will present the first of two original papers the Institute has commissioned for this conference. His focused on the question of what's the best way to finance a national grid, publicly or privately. We'll move next to the key issue of regulatory barriers to grid construction. And Drew Thornley, author of Energy and the Environment, Myths and Facts, and a member of the business law faculty at the University of Texas, Austin, will frame a new approach that may help break an old logjam. Next, two distinguished respondents, Mark Robinson, former director of energy projects for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Ashley Brown, executive director of the Harvard Electricity Policy Group and a former member of the Ohio Public Utilities Commission, will join us in discussion about the ideas advanced by our three main speakers, following which we'll invite questions and discussion. Finally, our luncheon speaker, Susan Eisenhower, president of the consulting firm, the Eisenhower Group, and a member of the Department of Energy's Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, will reflect on the ways in which the challenge of building a national electricity grid compares and contrasts with that of the Federal Interstate Highway Administration, spearheaded by President Eisenhower. The full biographies of all our program participants can be found in your programs. We begin with Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow Peter Huber.
you take this computer away? Well, to set the record straight, I actually did give a talk 2 years ago, but I certainly wasn't the person who conceived of building a national grid. That was, I believe, people in this room, and they were the ones who persuaded me how imminently and technically and economically feasible it was. However, I have been a big fan of grid for a long time, and I have enough numbers and technical competence, if not to switch that off, to tell you, as a fact, an engineering fact, this is the most valuable and important energy technology in the country today. It's this technology, which is a cable, one of many used in high voltage transmission, has done more to increase energy efficiency and reduce the cost of the energy we use every day than all of the energy improvements that we have put under the hood of our car since Henry Ford rolled out the first Model T. I mean, the numbers are rock solid. They're easy to demonstrate. This is the eBay for energy. It's what lets you shop online for coal, gas, uranium, water behind a dam, wind, wood, sun. It allows you to buy fuel by the tiny little smidgen and to rent space in million horsepower turbines by the millisecond. And those things run much, much more efficiently than anything you can put in your home or under the hood of your car. And because they do, and they transform much cheaper fuels, raw fuels, into as cheap as wind or coal or uranium, or take your pick, into very high-grade energy, electricity, far better than small dispersed systems can do. One of these wires, I've given these numbers before, they never cease to stun me. I must say I was stunned when I first calculated them and looked at them. One of these wires can transmit enough energy to fly a 747, three 747s at 500 miles an hour at 765 volts. That's a lot of energy, a lot of power moving in one of these wires. You typically put them in a wire, in a line. It's called a line, which is a 3 6-cable bundles. That's 54 jumbo jets worth of energy at cruise running down that one line, which is quite a small footprint these days as well. One complete line, a rather small footprint, can move about 1% of the total average US electric load, a year-round average, or about 0.5% of the total peak load. I mean, people just don't have any conception of how dense and compact and efficient electricity is. The technology for running these lines at close to 1 million volts peak, or 765,000 volts root mean square, if you want to be technical about it, that technology is relatively new. It is stunningly efficient in both electrical and economic terms. We have today the technology in hand. It's deployed. This is not pie in the sky. This is not after Washington throws another $100 billion at it or so. It's running today, and we have the technology to knit together a national grid if we wish to, and to do so cheaply. The economics are there as well. Three sort of core economic facts about electricity. First, demand for power is fickle. It goes up and down. It rises and falls with time of day and weather and seasons. Second, supply is fickle. Supply is fickle not only because you have fickle supplies like windmills and so on, but because it's the flip side of demand. If you build a big power plant somewhere near a load and the load is going up and down, that means the availability of extra power from that plant is going down and up and out of sync. So when people aren't using the power here, you've got a plant that could be generating power for somebody else but isn't. And the third absolutely key economic or technical fact is that the market demands just absolutely rock steady voltage at the plug 24/7. So you've got fickle supply, fickle demand, but you aggregate demand, but at the plug, at the individual plug, you need absolute stability, and this is the steadying technology. I mean, this is what smooths it all out. If you've got enough of this, here's the problem. Fickle is expensive. It's about twice as expensive as steady, looking at the national average numbers today. This oversimplifies a lot, but it provides a boundary on what we're talking about here. We know the difference between the price of fickle power and the price of steady power. It's in all our numbers everywhere. If you could do the following, and I grant you it's a hypothetical, but it's not a far-fetched one. If we could actually steady out all our loads in this country, okay? If we could basically do what people in the industry say, convert all our loads from some peak and some valleys into base load power, we would cut the average price of electricity at the plug for everybody by about 30 to 50%. We know that is a hard economic fact because that is roughly fairly close. That is about the kind of gap we're looking at nationwide between peak prices and baseload prices. Now, beginning in a serious way in 1992, in a less serious way, somewhat earlier than that, this city basically began deregulating sort of one piece of this infrastructure, basically the generation side. To oversimplify quite a lot, we basically deregulated the price of electricity when it gets wheeled across interstate lines. Utilities quickly split themselves up, many did, into grid companies, which still had their wire companies, which still remained regulated, and then generating companies whose power was not regulated. Today, before it ever lights a bulb or a computer screen, roughly half of all the power is now traded commodity-like among wholesalers, like wheat or commodities futures. Deregulation of the plants attracted lots of new investment in the new unregulated power plants. Merchant generators, the deregulated ones, now own, I think it's about one-third and rising of all the nation's generating capacity. They just moved in fast, they invested aggressively, and they had a major impact on the mix of fuels we're using and on the price of electricity. We've done nothing comparable on the grid side. In fact, investment has moved rapidly away from the grid side. The regulatory obstacles remain very high. And we see this is clearly reflected in the prices today. I mean, the average retail price of electricity is about 9 cents a kilowatt hour nationwide. Peak wholesale prices vary by 1 to 3 cents at any given moment of time across the country. You could be moving that power for well under a cent a kilowatt hour over wires like this. So we have big wholesale price gaps. We have the technology to even them out. We just aren't doing it. There is the economists can take it from there, and the numbers get hairy fast, but the potential opportunity for gaining here, the numbers are just unequivocal and rock solid. There is a huge opportunity, whatever the generating capacity it is you like, whether you want it to be greener or whether you want it to be cheaper or some mix of both, right? There is a huge opportunity to just begin using electricity to substitute for electricity in this country. We aren't doing it as well as we should. At many hours of the day, there are utilities straining to maintain the voltage in their wires, while there are others a third of the continent away who have cheap capacity standing idle. On an average day and night over the course of an entire year, about half of the total capacity in the country stands idle. And finally, today's grid simply cannot handle significant wind or solar or anything that is fickle or episodic. It is an engineering fact that if we build enough of those windmills and then plug them into the grid, we would just begin blowing huge fuses all over the place. I mean, it's the grid, when you're flying jumbo jets, down a few wires and people begin turning it on and off, it gets ugly very fast. I mean, this is a great deal of power, and when you stop it and start it up, suddenly things just go boom. If producers could freely choose to build power plants where it makes the most sense to build them, if every power plant could be sited where land is cheap and where the immediate neighbors welcome the investment and where the coal or uranium or gas or wind or take your pick or sun is most readily available, where you are least likely to damage sensitive ecosystems and therefore least likely to see your costs blow up when the lawyers pile on, if all your plants could be built in the places where pollution control can be installed most economically, if you could do all that and spin 500 or 1,000 megawatts of power 24/7 every day of the year, knowing that the wire will somehow deliver that power to 500 or 1,000 megawatts of rock steady load, if every power plant could be built and operated that way, again, the economic impact you're looking at is something like 30 to 50% of our current costs. And wire lowers the cost of fuel. It lets you run the cheapest fuel wherever it is and use the cheapest fuel wherever it is available, whether it's wind or coal. Again, I don't want to wade into that. It lets you use the cheapest socially acceptable fuel full time and less acceptable ones less. It sharply lowers the cost of capital. Electricity is a very capital intensive industry, and if you can use it 90% of the time, your cost of capital drops far below if you're using it 20% of the time, as we are with most of our gas-fired facility for today. Finally, this is a point I cannot fail to end with every time. It is often said, you know, that our biggest energy problem is oil, and, you know, don't talk to me about electricity because they're not related. Electricity, not oil, is the heart of the U.S. energy economy. It's easy to forget, or many people have never even learned it the first time. In dollars at current prices, we are spending more on oil, perhaps $500 billion a year, and a mere $350 billion a year on electricity, but we pour as much raw energy into our electric power plants as our total oil consumption, all the oil in all our cars, trucks, planes, chemical plants, factories, home furnaces. We're putting that same amount of energy into the electric power plants. They are converting it into useful stuff for us much more efficiently than any of the systems that are running oil and natural gas nearer the loads. Almost all of the fuel in the electric that's generating electricity for us is domestic. It's made at home. It's built in America. The center of gravity of our energy economy has been switching towards electricity since Thomas Edison fired up the first generator on Wall Street 100 years ago. In the thermal sector, electricity displaces oil and natural gas when you go to lasers and microwaves and electric welders and so on, just as it displaces gas in your kitchen when you microwave the coffee rather than switching on the stove. And it displaces it not because Washington subsidizes it or because there are mandates, but because electricity can be beautifully focused on one target and is very precise and easy to control and compact and clean on the premises. About 85% of the growth of our total energy consumption in the last, 30 or 40 years has come as energy delivered through the wires, not in our cars, not anywhere else. That is the growth sector. All of the highest growth sectors of our economy, the information sector and the telecom, run increasingly on electricity. The electric consumption, electricity used to, you know, the last point is this, and it's a number I think very few people know. Oil consumption as a fraction of our energy economy peaked in 1977 at just shy of 50%. It is under 40% today. That is an enormous change, okay? Granted, 30 years seems like a long time, but for something that is so crucial to our economy, that is such an integral part of our infrastructure, that you know, that has all this capital tied to it, a drop of 10 points is a very big drop. We would do well to drop it another 10 points. How did that happen? Two things happened. Electrification was the single biggest factor, was using not oil fuels to spin electric turbines. And the other factor was natural gas displacing oil, which is another good trend, one also I support. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Gilbert Metcalf.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be here today. So I'm here to talk about. I have the easier task. We're talking about paying for a national transmission grid and overcoming the barriers. Why are we talking about a national grid? Well, we're talking because we're looking at increased penetration of renewable electricity because of concerns about climate change and other issues. There have been various studies looking at the potential for 20% renewable electricity by 2030 at the national level. Other studies have looked at the eastern part of the United States with the idea of going to 20% or more renewable electricity by 2024. And the vehicle to doing that is to have Midwestern wind farms and some offshore wind primarily. To do either of these, to get either of these forms of penetration, you need a significant investments in the national grid. Of course, we also have growing demand for electricity for some of the reasons that Peter mentioned. It's a high quality energy source and quite desirable. If we go to electric vehicles, this is really a substitution of coal for oil in the United States and perhaps natural gas, but the vehicle is through electricity. So my job is actually pretty easy. If the two issues are how do we pay for it and overcoming regulatory barriers, my job is done very quickly, and then I leave the heavy lifting for Drew, because it is really, in the grand scheme, not that expensive to do the kinds of investments we need to do. And we have the structures in place for these to be financed through the private sector. The government's job really here is to provide the appropriate regulatory structures to reduce the barriers to making these investments. So as an economist, it's very easy for me to say, well, it's all just about the cost allocation. That's a political decision, but that can be sorted out, and we'll let our distinguished colleagues tell us how we sort it out. Obviously, these are not trivial or simple issues, but the issue is not the cost. I'll skip this. This is just to make the point that we have an electricity network depends on many components, and of course, we're talking about the transmission component here today. Where does electricity come from? Well, we generate it, and today we have about 1,000 gigawatts of generating capacity in the United States. A gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts, which in turn is 1,000 kilowatts. And of course, the focus for thinking about expanding the grid to some extent is the non-hydro renewables, which is wind, solar, geothermal, which in as a share of capacity is 4%. As a share of actual generation, it's even less. It's about 1%. But this is where the action is in terms of one of the big drivers of a national transmission grid is our ability to integrate this intermittent technology, generating technology, which importantly is most desirably located in parts of the country, the Southwest for solar, the plains and mountain states for wind, that are far away from the demand. So we need to move the electricity around, and of course that's what the national transmission grid is all about. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC, does excellent studies of what our transmission and distribution needs are, what are the growth rates required. I talk about that some in the paper. Let me just give one statistic. Looking historically, we have been building about 6,000 circuit miles over five-year planning periods. Moving ahead, we need to build about 16,000 versus 6,000 over a comparable time period. And about a third of that anticipated growth is for integrating renewable energy generation into the grid. So we have big bottlenecks that we need to address, and of course that's one of the reasons for this conference. Based on the NERC data in the report, the most recent report that I had access to in writing this paper, the cost of the investments we need over the coming decade are on the order of $90 to $100 billion in 2008 dollars. It's a lot of money, but as a share of total retail electricity costs, it's on the order of 7%. So it is eminently manageable. It is not the cost is not the bottleneck here. There are important regulatory issues. The left-hand chart just simply shows the different planning organizations within the United States and parts of Canada. We have different regional planning groups. Some parts of the country don't have regional planning groups as yet. So one of the issues that we face with national transmission investment planning is dealing with multiple states and multiple planning groups. And also, looking at the right-hand chart, we have differing degrees of market deregulation in parts of the country. So the white states in this chart have not have the traditional vertically integrated rate of return regulated utilities. Green states are states that have done varying degrees of market deregulation, typically at the wholesale and generation level. And then the yellow states are states that have done some degree of restructuring, but then have put some of those on hold. The point here is we have great variability, and this increases the challenge of doing integrated planning and interstate planning. How do we pay for grid additions? Well, there are well-established approaches. One approach I just want to talk about a bit because it has its analog in perfectly competitive markets for other kinds of commodities is the notion of transmission congestion charging. But there are other approaches. We can if we have new grid addition, we can allocate the cost sort of broadly across users of the grid, cost socialization or postage stamp approaches. We can use beneficiary pay approaches if we can identify the beneficiaries, which is not always a trivial task. And we'll likely end up using a mix of methods. But let me just talk briefly about the notion of congestion charging, because it's one that many people have talked about as sort of the ideal approach to pricing electricity. So let me give a very simple example of we have two We have a system that's looking to buy electricity from generators and distribute it to consumers. So we have a system planning who entertains bids to supply electricity. And so we have two generators, generator A over here, who's offering to supply electricity at $50 a megawatt hour. That's 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And generator B over here has a higher cost structure and so is offering electricity at $80 a megawatt hour. Meanwhile, we have demand for electricity, which happens to be over here next to the high-cost generator for 100 megawatt hours. And let's assume we're looking at a single-hour increment. And so the system planner looks at this, and in a world with no constraints, the planner would say, okay, well, we'll buy all the electricity from generator A and ship it over to the consumers at point B, and we'll have electricity at $50 per megawatt hour. But now we have this transmission constraint that we can only move 40 megawatts of electricity from point A to point B. If we try to put more through the line, it blows the line out. We have a blackout. So the optimal solution in that case is to supply as much as we can, subject to the transmission constraint, from generator A and pay generator A $50 a megawatt hour. And the residual amount, the remaining amount, comes from generator B, the high-cost generator. They get paid their bids. Consumers pay the marginal cost of electricity, and at the margin, each additional megawatt hour of electricity costs $80 because it's going to have to come from generator B because they're not constrained by the transmission constraint. They pay $80, and this leads to an excess payment because for the 40 megawatt hours that came from generator A is receiving $50. Consumers are paying $80, and so we have $30 per megawatt hour or $1,200 available as a transmission congestion charge. And this is funds that can go to the owner of the transmission line to pay for that capital investment. In the real world, we end up having a congestion contracts. There's all sorts of financial contracts as to how we do this, but this is potentially the source of funding for expanding and maintaining the grid. Now, that has a lot of desirable properties. First off, it provides an efficient signal to encourage new investment and the appropriate amount of investment, and it also encourages consumers to reduce demand in heavily congested areas because the price that they face goes up. And under certain conditions that are sort of analogous to perfectly competitive markets, in fact, you can show, and a number of engineers and economists have shown this over the years, that you can actually pay for the entire optimally sized grid through transmission congestion charging. Now, that's a great sort of perfect markets analog. And you can do this with merchant projects or managed investments. The difficulty is that in the real world, it is unlikely to finance the entire investment cost. Studies that have been done in other countries looking at data suggest that we're talking on the order to 20 to 25% of the cost, maybe 30% could be financed through transmission congestion charges. So we can get the right pricing signal, but we still are going to need other vehicles for bringing in the revenues required to pay for the projects. And there are a variety of cost allocation approaches that can be used. We can allocate the cost across all users if it's difficult to determine who are the beneficiaries of a project. To the extent that we can identify beneficiaries, we can apply cost to them through the beneficiaries pay principle. There are a variety of other approaches. And these are clearly important issues as to how we do this. FERC is struggling with this, as are regional planning groups. As an economist, I say clearly it's a political issue. We have to make a decision, and until those rules get sorted out, that does certainly provide bottlenecks to moving forward. But the point here is that it is not the cost itself that's the issue. It is the political problem of how we're going to pay for those costs. Now, there are a couple of issues that I think are relevant to just put on the table before I turn things over to Drew, and that is that I think a couple of financing issues that are worth mentioning that I talk about in the paper. One of them is the issue of anticipatory network builds. This is the point that there are both political and economic fixed costs that make it desirable often to overbuild a system, a transmission system, in anticipation of future economic and electricity demand growth. And of course, if we do this, we need transition allocation models to determine who pays for the surplus capacity until we can build out to it. The point here is that, again, it's an allocation issue, but contrary to what a number of governors from the Western states argued a couple of years ago, it does not require federal funding to do this. It's simply working this out within the regulatory structure. And the second issue is to recognize that electricity transmission is not a simple matter of, I put the electricity in this pipe and it comes out that pipe. Electricity is subject to the dictates of Kirchhoff's laws of physics that determine that when you put electricity into the grid, it flows through the entire grid. And so there are important externality issues, spillover issues, that when I make a decision to do an investment here, it is going to have impacts on transmission investment in other parts of the country in ways that can be either beneficial or deleterious to those other transmission lines. And so this really speaks to the importance of the federal role in both overseeing and really pushing through the appropriate kinds of regulatory structures to overcome state-level resistance, where states are making decisions about lines coming through the states that don't take into account the positive spillovers and benefits to other states. This is really an issue that we've been struggling with for a number of years, and we will continue to struggle with this, and we're going to hear more about it from our other speakers, but it really does speak to the central role that the federal government needs to play in setting the rules of the game in a way that can get us this grid investment in a national transmission grid that we're going to need for the 21st century. Thank you.
Just before I bring up Drew, I would just like to hone in real quickly. I think a lot of people in this city would be surprised to hear you say we don't need federal money. You just talked about it in terms of those Western governors. I wonder if you could just clarify what is the difference between this and other big infrastructure projects in the simplest terms as to why a big government investment isn't necessary.
Well, I think that the central issue here is that it is in the interest of the generators of electricity to have this transmission capacity in place, as well as consumers, and we have mechanisms in place to pay for it. And moreover, the cost of it is a small part of the total cost of electricity. So it does differ, I think, in important ways from, say, an interstate highway system, which is much more capital. The figuring out a way to allocate that is much more difficult because of the dispersed nature of the users of a highway network as opposed to electricity.
So sounds similar, but in some ways different. And we're going to get to that later in our program. Now getting to the issue of regulatory barriers, Drew Thornley.
Close this, Professor. Sorry, Professor Merkav. I didn't know how to do the heavy lifting today, or I probably would have stretched or dressed more appropriately. But it's good to be here. Speaking of how I'm dressed, a black suit would not go over well today in my hometown of Austin, Texas. So although it's not cold here, a few hours of a little temperature relief is nice. Thanks to the Manhattan Institute. Thanks to everyone at the Institute who played a part in this paper, Ben Gerson and everyone else, I appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who contributed to the paper with commenting and interviews and expertise, I appreciate it, and thanks to everyone who's attending today. My paper's focus is not on the need for or the case for a modernized extra high voltage interstate electric grid. Peter's paper does that, and my paper is not on how we pay for it. That's what Professor Metcalf's paper is all about. My paper is on the barriers to achieving such a grid. If we are going to move forward and pursue this modernized interstate electric grid, what are the barriers, in particular, the regulatory barriers that stand in the way, that stand in the path? There are many barriers. The the local, not in my backyard objections, objections from environmentalists who are worried about how land will be affected by these proposed lines. The tax code, as Professor Metcalf deals with in his paper, its disparate treatment of various energy sources. But my paper looks at what I believe to be the chief regulatory barrier, and that is the multiple layers of review and approval that are required to get a line sited. So it's about planning and siting, and my paper also deals a little bit with cost allocation, as Professor Metcalf mentioned. The myriad layers, the way we have it now, we have every state has its own system of planning and siting lines. We have at least one major planning or siting authority, a public utility commission or something by another name in each state. Some of these delegate authority to the localities where such projects will be located, where these lines would be. You have wholesale markets, regional grid operators that have a say so often. You have federal agencies whose interests would be affected. For example, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service. If a proposed line is going to affect their interests, they would need to weigh in and sign off and give approval. So we have this kind of patchwork, this state-by-state system of planning and siting that leads to a large degree of regulatory uncertainty for our transmission developers. The result, quite simply, too much time, too much money. It's an inefficient system. It's unpredictable. As I said, what we need is certainty moving forward if we're going to plan the grid that's going to deliver to us the benefits of the grid that we need. Oftentimes, a single state can keep an interstate line from being approved and thus built, or can delay a project to the point where the cost no longer makes sense and projects are abandoned. This happens often, and my paper deals with a few. For example, I mentioned a project where the line took just 2 years to build but 8 years to plan. I mentioned another one from AEP where it took 13 years to get all the necessary permits and approvals and less than three to construct for this 90-mile line. The solution, and I'm mindful of my time, I don't have enough time to go on to the details, but quite simply, a system of dual siting authority, a dual siting regime whereby we have the status quo for our lower voltage interstate lines, our intrastate lines, and all of our local distribution. Status quo meaning the various states, we keep things like they are. But then for our really heavy wires, like Peter brought, for our extra high voltage, things above 345 kV, we have ultimate federal authority to site and approve these lines. I think there's a major misconception here and a huge worry for particular states' riders and ardent federalists, myself included, that this implies or necessitates a complete federal government takeover, and it certainly does not. What I mean and what my paper discusses is two systems complementing one another, not a takeover, but a tag team, two systems working together in tandem for these extra high voltage interstate lines. The federal authority would be a backup authority whereby FERC or another body would have the say-so as to what lines would be in the national interests, and then give the states, give the interested parties a chance to work this out, to work out the details and the fine print. If they don't do so, the feds would have a chance to then step in and site the lines. This would allow for nationally beneficial lines to get sited if the states cannot come to an agreement and work out the specifics. This is a proper manifestation of the Federal Commerce Clause power. This is a proper manifestation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. Electrons, quite simply, are articles of commerce that cross state lines. As Professor Metcalf said, when you put power on a line, you're not going to direct it to one place. It's going to follow the path of least resistance, and it's going to disperse. This is about economic regulation, this interstate commerce aspect, because power goes all over. This is not about commandeering the states. This is not about assessing civil penalties or about takings. So I don't see any major issues here in terms of, does the federal government have the authority? Yes, they do. But we can limit it in a certain way, right? Give the states a chance to work it out. As I said, states would retain the control over not only the lines within their states, but also the lower voltage interstate lines. And this shows that this is not a bad faith play by the federal government, because they're leaving the status quo for those lower voltage wires that are not meant to do what we want this new grid to do, that are not meant to carry these remote power sources to the load centers. So we limit this federal authority to those lines that are for this type of grid. Who should get this power? My paper explores this. It remains an open question. Definitely FERC would be a party that would make sense because they do have experience in the regulation of transmission, in the regulation of interstate gas pipelines. But we could also explore some other independent federal body, perhaps one where state utility regulators or others from states could have seats and thus have a more direct say-so. States are integral to this process. They're not left out of the process. My paper talks about the procedural safeguards that would be put in place to make sure that the states are protected, their legitimate interests are protected, and they're not trampled on unreasonably, and they would get a first bite at the apple, as I mentioned above. Lastly, however this grid is constructed, and whatever party is given the authority ultimately to site these lines that are in the national interests, my paper proposes a policy of fuel neutrality, that we shouldn't play favorites when it comes to picking our energy sources. That if you can put power on the line and send it to those places that need that extra power, you can put it on the line, and we have no stranded investment, and we have a grid that is utilized to the fullest, to everyone's benefit. And then the last thing, in addition to fuel neutrality, I mentioned cost allocation. This is another area where we need a flexible approach, that we need a no-one-size-fits-all solution, one where we have regional flexibility, but we have the federal body, FERC or another, that are ready to step in if rates are unjust or unreasonable. Developers, transmission developers, wherever they're located, they should be allowed to recover their legitimate fixed and variable costs and earn a reasonable profit on their investment. Thank you very much.
All right, now we're going to try to mix it up a little bit and to draw out our distinguished discussants here who will react both to Drew and Gibbs' paper, but also to a few questions that I'm going to throw at you. And we heard about, I'm going to take things a little bit out of order here, but we heard about the regulatory barriers. Ashley Brown, I wonder if I could ask you to take off your Harvard hat and to put back on your Ohio Public Utilities Commission hat. And if a high voltage interstate transmission line proposal were coming to you, how do you think about that? Is that a good day because, well, we're going to have jobs for Ohioans and they're going to build this line and it's going to go through a lot of people's backyards, but, well, probably some of them will get a little bit of compensation for that. Or is that a bad day for you because people are going to be outside of your office protesting and you'd rather just put that off?
Well, first I should say that when I was a regulator.
Can everybody hear Ashley?
Okay. First, I should say when I was a regulator, it was more respectable to tell my mother I played the piano in a bordello, which was fine as long as I played the piano. But the answer, it's a complicated question, actually, because you look at it in two different ways. I mean, one of the things you need to think about transmission lines, particularly high-voltage, long-distance lines, is that there's an incredible asymmetry between the benefits and the costs. The costs, at least in terms of the environmental insults or the aesthetic insults, however you want to put it, are exclusively local. And as a result, you can't just look at the costs in economic terms. And so let's assume that the benefits, so one of the questions I would ask as a regulator is who's getting the benefits? Are my ratepayers or are they ratepayers in neighboring states? That shouldn't change from an overall public policy perspective, the answer. But in fact, it does for the following reasons. One is the asymmetry between costs and benefits. The second is who pays. If a utility is building it and they want to put it into retail rate base, what they're really saying is, we want to socialize the risks associated with this line and socialize it on the backs of a particular subset of ratepayers who may not be the beneficiaries, and certainly are disproportionate. If they're bearing 100% of the residual revenue requirement, they're not 100% of the beneficiaries. So is there a logic to that? So I'm going to want to know, how are we going to allocate these costs, not just the costs in terms of who's going to pay the rates, but who's bearing the residual risk of meeting the revenue requirements for that line. Another issue I think that we need to think about, in this case, I don't think it's necessarily a legitimate one, but you'll hear from constituents about, are the very question Drew was talking about, which resources are going to be affected, and how are they going to be affected? The Northeast governors, for example, are nervous that coal might creep onto the wires and seep into the Northeast. One could argue that the county commissioners in Southeast Ohio are going to be arguing, God, those ugly wind electrons will be seeping into the wires and disrupting the coal market. So you're going to hear a lot from people about the effect on resources. Another is interesting, where is the split among environmentalists. Environmentalists are anything but united on this issue. The folks concerned about air quality, of course, are pushing renewables, and they've never seen the transmission line they haven't fallen in love with. On the other hand, the land and water people think all generators ought to be near load. And so therefore, they're going to say that any transmission has huge environmental consequences and we need to do that. You're also going to hear from, NIMBY folks, who don't want anywhere near them. But they're not usually motivated just by, NIMBYism is sort of amorphous, but you have to think back to what I said earlier about this asymmetry. They're bearing an enormous part of the cost, and they're not getting the same asymmetrical level of benefit from it. And so you can call it NIMBYism, and I do myself, which is cynical, but in some senses, it's not an illegitimate concern. You can understand why they have those concerns.
Well, now you're making it sound a lot harder than we were wanting it to sound.
That's why I went to law school.
Right. But so let's Drew tried to give us an approach to that. Let's have the states work on this for a couple of years. So utility comes, we want to build high voltage. You guys work on this for a couple of years. We'll give you a couple of years to resolve these issues. But if you don't, Mark Robinson's going to step in. He's going to go back into government service, and he's going to step in and preempt your right to say no, because the beneficiaries are asymmetrically aligned with the ratepayers. So, Mark, does Drew's solution, or any solution that you're familiar with, start to address this Gordian knot that Ashley Brown has so well described for us?
Yes, it starts to address it. My concern is that, and I don't disagree with anything that Drew or Gilbert said, but my concern is that the recommendations don't go far enough if you actually want to construct transmission in this country. It has grown ever more difficult to build any type of energy infrastructure in the United States, and electric transmission is there right with it. If you want to get transmission built in this country, I think it's not just a matter of having backup authority for somebody to step in when things break down. I think you have to bite the bullet and decide that you are going to vest in an entity the authority and the responsibility, and it doesn't have to be FERC. I don't work there anymore, so this is not an advertisement. but vest in an entity that authority to make the decisions in the public interest that do account for, but understand that it's not just the economics impacts on those individuals in that one state, but that there's an economic interdependence in this country between states and within regions and among regions. And that if you don't have an electric system that supports that economic interdependence, all states will suffer, including those individuals who unfortunately might have an electric transmission line going through in their neighborhood. So the idea that you let the states play with it, and then ultimately it would go to another entity for some backstop authority, basically what you've done is you've taken a problem, you've let it fester for a year or two somewhere, mm-hmm. and then you've told another group, well, now that it's really a problem, you handle it. You take it and handle it. That's not the paradigm that we developed at FERC for siting energy infrastructure. What we did was to decide that the regulator, and I love being called a regulatory barrier.
Enabler.
For 30 years I was a regulatory barrier. But what we did was to decide that at the earliest possible moment, we would get the regulator in play with all parties who may be affected and try to minimize the impacts associated with whatever energy infrastructure we're dealing with. And I dealt with dams and transmission lines and gas pipelines and LNG facilities, among other things. And that works. But if you let it fester for 2 years with the states and it calcifies positions, they come to FERC, nobody changes their position. Nobody's ready to negotiate. And now FERC is in a posture of, well, we're the bad guys and we'll try to cut this, and it doesn't work. So the whole backstop process with the national energy corridors, although it was moving in the right direction, and in the 2005 bill was an advancement, it doesn't go to where you need to go to actually get something built. It doesn't have all the principles in place that you need to build energy infrastructure in this country.
All right, so I'd like to underscore something you said right at the start of your remarks there. That is, it's nobody's job right now to ensure that a national electricity grid will be built. Right? You have proposers of that right. in individual segments, but there's no part of the government whose mandate it is to see to it. Is that the core point you're making?
It is, and there's no legislative / regulatory environment that is in place because Congress has told an entity that it's in the interest of the U.S. to move forward with electric transmission construction. And until that happens, everybody is going to be moving off on cost allocation issues and trying to solve those, and planning issues and trying to solve those, and siting issues and looking at those, and nobody's doing the entire gamut and with the focus of how do we do it in a way that we discipline planning, which is the biggest problem with planning. It just goes on, you just keep digging a bigger hole. That we have cost allocation procedures in place that allow great flexibility in deciding what to do with each particular line in terms of who's coming and into the entity that's making the decisions, and that we have siting that recognizes the impacts locally, but also can evaluate those in the context of regional and national needs.
Mm-hmm. So how are you feeling about this, Ashley? Right. So we have. Drew Thornley says, well, you guys get to confab about this for a couple of years, and then Big Brother is going to come in and make it happen. Sorry about that. Right. But then Mark Robinson is saying, well, actually, that just isn't really going to work in the real world. The initial planning process has got to be vested with federal authorities because it's truly an interstate system. And then actually they're going to come to you and say, well, we want to hear your opinion. Don't get us wrong. How are you going to be feeling about that?
So now I can take off my Ohio hat and talk about what I think about policy.
Okay. You can do both, but I still want you in Ohio a little bit.
Which is, you do have to keep your eye out. The big focus has to be on the benefits. But what you need to do is spread the costs in some way that's commensurate where the benefits are felt. So I think there is a need for a strong federal role. And when you raise the question, is there a need for government investment? That's a different question than the question, is there a need for a strong federal government role? And the answer is there is a need for a strong governmental role to look at these broader regional benefits and to overrule any sort of parochialism that may cause them to be lost. On the other hand, you can't dismiss the local concerns as being illegitimate. You need to find a way to address them. So I prefer to find some kind of system for siting these lines that really reflects the local input, but ultimately that's not where the decision resides. And I think that there has to be some kind of balance. I mean, there are joint board mechanisms at FERC, which FERC has chosen never to use. But you could use, if FERC acquired siting authority, this might be a good place to do that. So you do have some sort of mix of the local and national input into the process. The other thing I wanted to address, which is in Drew's paper, is I think the idea that we can designate, lower voltage lines, I'm talking about still transmission, not distribution level, as being local and federal, being something bigger. I don't think that works. I mean, I think we need relatively as much seamlessness as we can possibly get. And so whatever the role is for siting any level of transmission, it ought to be the level
for
siting.
If it's transmission.
Transmission, yeah. Local distribution is a different story. But, you know, that I think needs to be, I think we need one seamless way to do that. I think that just overly complicates things.
And Drew, was that your preference, or was that your tipping your hat to political reality?
Well, I think that, you know, having that dividing line shows that we're trying to delicately balance these competing interests, this status quo, and this need for a federal input or some federal authority, because energy is a national issue. So I thought, if a new line comes up that we clearly are intending for this type of extra high voltage, sending it across the state lines, kind of heavy duty line, then that would be a way to sort of appease the states who might otherwise be worried about it. And one other thing I want to say is that
appease. Okay.
All right. Trying to keep everybody happy is not going to be an easy task. But I would say that, far from digging a hole, I think that this plan of you get a 2-year bite at the apple, and then we're going to step in. We may look like the bad guy, but somebody's got to make a decision. It's better than a 13-year languishing. It's better than an 8-year kind of uncertainty. It is another way to strike this balance between a complete federal takeover and doing absolutely nothing, right? So it's a way that, you know, that this plan could be not be a political non-starter from the very beginning. And other thing I would say is that the grid was built over time in pieces. And this national grid, if we move to it, is not going to happen overnight. It's going to kind of spring up piece by piece. And so I think the regulations that attend to it should be kind of incremental as well, instead of just, you know, going for the gold right at the beginning.
Right. So we're struggling with how we can create a politically realistic approach to this. And we have different views on this. Skip, did you want to get in on that?
I just want to make a quick comment that, from an economic point of view, that not to pick on Drew's proposal, but it does illustrate the complexity that if we have like a rule that says that states get to do intrastate investment and the feds have no role to play here, well, even an intrastate line has interstate implications because of the Kirchhoff's laws and the ways that electrons flow. So it adds some complexity there. And the second point is that if we have a rule that, you know, 345K lines are state and 765 are national,
right,
you now have incentives that, well, if it's easier to site things nationally, I'm going to build lines. Maybe I really want to do a 345 line, but I'm going to do a 765 line because I can get that one built. And so now we begin to get distortions in the system because of game playing.
So unintended consequences because of the. Let me get a sense, going back to Mark Robinson. We've heard references somewhat that may be obscure to some people in our audience here this morning. National Electricity Policy Act of 2005, national electricity corridors. We've started to struggle with exactly these issues, how we can facilitate interstate high voltage transmission lines. What's the state of play right now?
Well, the EPAC 2005, which gave FERC backstop siting authority for electric transmission, was a step in the right direction. It went down the path that Drew has described. And given where it was, that was an improvement because things did languish. However, then we had the Fourth Circuit decision, which undercut the...
Let me just slow you down. So okay. The legislation 2005 gave the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which we're all fondly referring to as FERC, right, the power to designate certain areas as national, of national importance, such that you could build a line down that corridor.
Yeah. I wish they had, but they gave that to DOE, and they split the authority there, which required 2 years for DOE to come up with what those corridors would be. Originally, there was discussion in the development of EPAC 2005 of lodging it all in one place, but it got split. As it may be, that got taken care of. Two corridors were designated. Not a spade of dirt yet has turned as a result of the EPAC 2005 bill and the backstop authority of FERC. It being there may have stimulated some states to act, but nothing has been done under FERC's authority. Since then, the Fourth Circuit undercut that decision with, that I won't go into, but another round of legislation started in around March of 2009 with Senator Reid and his Green Highways proposal, and it has carried on, and it's now in.
So that's sounding good to me. If Senator Reid is behind this,
yeah,
should I be happy about it?
He's behind it, but there's a lot of misunderstandings in the legislative process that you have to go through and correct, and get it to a point where it actually is some legislation that an entity like FERC can work with, and we did that through the spring of 2009. And ultimately, it came out with S-1462, which is the Bingaman bill that is out there now. The unfortunate part about the Bingaman bill is it also...
Now, they're talking about Senator Bingham from New Mexico, right?
Yes, correct. Okay. It also splits the authority on transit. And one of the principles of building energy infrastructure in this country is that you have to have some entity that's been given the mandate to get it done, or it doesn't happen. Just like they did in 2005 with LNG terminals in making FERC the exclusive authority for siting that. Here in the Bingaman bill, they have split it between the Department of Interior would basically develop all the record through their NEPA process for any transmission line that might touch federal lands, any federal lands, and almost all do. But yet FERC would be in a position of making the public interest determination of whether or not the line should be built. Well, you have an entity with a mission, Interior, which is to protect lands, developing a record that their people would say is the record which is has that focus in it.
That's the basis of the decision.
Of a decision where an entity is focused on trying to get necessary infrastructure constructed. So it sets up a system, for, in my opinion, for failure of an efficient method of getting transmission constructed, and really sets up a conflict between two entities on deciding whether or not something should or should not be built within the federal government.
Right, and so what made gas so different than that?
It has all six principles that I think are in Drew's paper covered in terms of exclusive authority, discipline schedule, one federal record, and on. All of those are covered in the Natural Gas Act and in provisions that have passed since then, but none of those are covered for electric transmission.
What makes a difference is history. The gas was located in a particular geographic region, the markets were located elsewhere, and you had to have a way to make the markets work and to link them. That's what electricity is emerging into, but we're stuck with a different history.
Right.
And we're stuck with a history of a locally, of highly balkanized industry, with a lot of local interests. And I, by the way, let me be clear about this. Some of the problems are the utilities themselves. There are utilities who have zero interest in having anybody find any way to get access to their local territory. Mm-hmm. They'll remain nameless, and it's not true of all utilities. But they exist, and they're as happy to be as parochial as they can possibly be. So it's not just a matter of, you know, crazy environmentalists. There are a lot of different commercial interests at stake here that make it even more complicated. But we're a victim of our history. I mean, I do a lot of work in Brazil, for example. In Brazil, the process is a whole lot easier. There's a planning process. They designate what corridors are needed. They go out to bid so that nobody has a lock on who's going to build the transmission. The lowest cost provider wins the bid. They build the transmission. It's a relatively low-risk business because the revenue is assured, and it works. They build, they expand. It works fairly well. I mean, it's only been in place now for 10 years. It came after a crisis where they had to change things. But the point is, it works. But we have a different history, and so a lot of what we're talking about is just trying to overcome some of the burdens that history's imposed on us.
Right, so we had a regulatory structure that was appropriate for a period in which we are no longer living.
That's a fair way to say it.
If you look at a map of the 345 kV line and above that's been built in this country since 2000, it's about 682 miles of it, but there are no three-state lines. They only cross one state line in each of those segments that adds up to that 682, and that, I think, reflects those utilities that have two-state responsibilities and they can go and get those lines done. But try to go in and do a three-state line where there's one state that's just passing through, and that's where it just doesn't happen, and the maps reflect that.
To give you an idea of how out of whack we are along those lines, I think there are only two or three states' siting laws that actually say you have to consider impacts out of state,
right,
which is phenomenal when you think about it. There are literally a handful of states that say that. Or look from the environmental point of view. The air quality people want to build more lines to move more renewables to energy. Do you know how many state siting laws say that's a positive effect that ought to be considered as a beneficial aspect in considering the siting of a new law? Not one.
Not one.
Right. So the law is completely out of sync with where we think we're going with policy.
Right, and so that's why we have this emergent move toward federalization of the whole situation. And the key point, which I'm hearing, is it's got to be somebody's job to care first about interstate high-voltage transmission lines. Mm-hmm. Right.
Also, I mean, we'd see more three-state lines or four-state lines or five-state lines if there weren't these barriers, right, for lack of a better word. And if we did have this sort of strengthened backstop authority, I mean, Mark mentioned that maybe this didn't go far enough. It did try to take a step in the right direction, albeit there's a legal challenge and there's some uncertainty of the Fourth Circuit. I've actually got a law review article coming up this spring that's just about that word withhold, and what do we do with that? And my paper proposes, whether it's 345 or whether you have to prove that this line is in the national interest, it does give a little more, put a little more meat on the bones, a little more tooth to this backstop authority. I think that is a positive incremental step.
Right. I'm going to bring the audience here in just 1 minute, but I'm not sure who I'm directing this question, but I'm going to start with Mark. If we were to have, just trying to get a sense of how the world would change, if there were to be a strong federal role that made it a lot easier to site these lines, how much are we going to see? In other words, are we going to start seeing these lines crisscrossing the country? Is the nature of our visual landscape going to change dramatically, or would we really not notice it that much because there's, as Peter points out, such powerful carriers that we don't need all that many?
Yeah, I think Drew was correct in that it would be incremental. And one of the principles of siting major energy infrastructure is that you have to be able to see a clear path between the investment of the first dollar and the potential for return on that dollar at the end. So if you did ultimately set up a system that had that mandate from Congress, the responsibilities and authorities rested in a party, and they could handle cost allocation in a flexible way, get discipline the planning process, and get siting done, I think you would start to see a pioneer come forward and try to use that process and see if it worked. And then as they made progress, I think others might do as well. But it would be incremental. You wouldn't see 18 people show up on the doorstep of whatever entity had that the next day and say, boy, I've been waiting for you.
You know, the other piece which Mark touched on that we haven't really talked about in this discussion much today is, and I would argue maybe a bigger barrier than the siting process, the transmission is the cost.
We were just getting to good news, Ashley. Okay, go ahead.
You know, I used to be a regulator. I can't help but deliver bad
okay.
news. Systemic. But it's the cost allocation problem. Because this is a huge problem, and I think many people think it's a bigger barrier than the siting process. Who's going to pay for this? How do we allocate the cost to pay for it? And who's going to take what level of risk? You know, I mentioned earlier about the question about utilities trying to put it in their local rate base, which I think is a mistake, actually, in terms of misallocates the cost. Another way to do it is say, well, let's just socialize the cost across the system. That's not a very efficient price signal. It's not very efficient. I mean, some people would like it because it's an assurance of recovery of the capital, but it's not very efficient in terms of the marketplace. It may or may not be justified in some cases. Based on use. The other is let's make the beneficiary pay. Well, most of us would agree with that in principle. The problem is, how do you know who the beneficiary is? Not only how do you know who it is, who do you know, who's it going to benefit 30 years from now when the asset is still hanging out there? And the answer is we don't know. And so you have a whole debate about, A, how do you allocate it? How permanent is the cost allocation? And the more permanent it is, I think the more resistance you're going to run into people who think if they game the system, they're going to get the benefit without having to pay their share of the benefit. And so you have all these problems that build up.
I got to bring Gib Metcalf back on that now, because you were proposing what you thought was an artful way to walk between Skill and Charybdis there. Are you daunted by Ashley's criticism?
No, I think Ashley is absolutely right. I think there have been people who have been arguing that transmission congestion charging approach is the panacea that gets us out of this, but it doesn't, because it doesn't cover the cost, and so you end up having to go to either socialization of beneficiary pays type approach for a lot of the cost. Not 100%, but you still have to do that. So you're not going to get completely efficient pricing signals. We can go partway there, but we still have this problem.
But we don't want to let the best be the enemy of the better either, right?
Never.
Ashley's not sure. Okay. I'd like to bring in questions from the audience. We've got some regulators hiding out here amongst us. If they want to come forward, they're welcome. And obviously some people from the industry. But questions for any member of the panel. Yes, sir.
Thanks. Hi, Jason Fortney with Platts. I was wondering if anybody could comment on FERC's notice of proposed rulemaking on cost allocation and transmission siting, what you think might be good or bad about it. FERC has said only beneficiaries should pay, or that should be roughly commensurate. If you had any feedback on that.
Mark, are you familiar with that?
Well, it's transmission, it's not transmission and siting, it's planning and cost allocation and trying to bring those two. I'll make just a general comment, not about the specifics of the NOPR, but the cost allocation aspects are being looked at legislatively right now as well. The Corker Amendment stepped in on the Bingaman bill and put it back into you've got to figure out who the beneficiaries are. It really slanted it that way. Exactly. I think there's an attempt out there to find the holy grail in cost allocation, that there is a perfect way to do it, and it's just not true. Each method you come up with will be criticized by a particular set of individuals who think they're being disadvantaged by that particular method. So what I think the answer is not necessarily FERC trying to take this Gordian knot and untie it and say that we've come up with this method, but rather starting with a legislative process which recognizes that cost allocation is going to be a sort of a public interest call that can vary from project to project, and then vest that very clearly so the courts understand, very clearly with an entity that is charged with looking at the project, looking at how the cost can be allocated, and not through a formula or even the attempts like with the SPP's highways and byways method, but rather make a judgment in the public interest on the record that's developed for cost allocation for that particular project. But you have to have that legislative foothold to do that, and then somebody like FERC or some other entity can execute. But if you continue to look for the process in cost allocation, we'll keep doing the same thing we're doing on planning, which was look for the perfect plan, which will change next week because some fact changes. You just never get there.
I actually have a very different take on that. I mean, first off, FERC is not doing this because they chose to do it. They did it because Senator Corker forced the issue, and even more important, Judge Posner in Chicago forced the issue. So FERC has to have something more than, well, we'll just do what we feel like we're going to do, which is almost what their policy had been up to now. But the problem is, if you don't have certain principles that are enunciated that are going to guide cost allocation decisions, you're going to have some real adverse effects. Number one is everything's going to become a local game because these are regional markets, and certain people play in certain regional markets, and certain folks aren't going to be interested in investing where the real issue is local gamesmanship. So if you want to attract capital on a larger scale, you need some clearly enunciated principles that are going to be uniformly applicable. Now, is it true that some projects will differ and you may need to deviate? Yeah, sure, that's true. But you have to have some general guidance. And quite frankly, FERC has been, until recently, FERC has been brain dead on this question. They have not given any guidance to anybody. That's hopefully, in this NOPR, that will change. And certainly the fact they're looking at it is very hopeful. But there's certain issues, for example, in NOPR they didn't look at. And that is this question about, do we do these cost allocations once and forget about it? There are differing views on that. My own view is, no, we ought to be reassessing those over periods of time. Look, the one thing we know about identifying the beneficiaries today for a line that's going to be built for 30 or 40 years of life is we're wrong. We will not get it right. There's never been a transmission line that was used entirely and exclusively for the benefit for which it was intended and for the beneficiaries for whom it was intended. Doesn't happen. Can't happen. So the question is, are we going to review that, or are we going to leave that standing forever? That FERC, that actually is not even addressed in the NOPR, that question. I think that's an important question. Now, let me say, if we review cost allocation, that doesn't change the revenue requirement. It shouldn't change rate of return issues. It's just a distribution issue of who's going to pay what portion of the cost. But this cost allocation issue is critically important because it establishes principles about pricing, it sends signals to customers, it sends signals to investors, it tells if we're going to have articulated policies on a national basis, it opens the world of investment opportunities to more people that may not have a local presence but have capital and want to put it to play in the market. So I think it's a mistake if we don't have at least some general principles that are uniformly applicable.
And I don't hear any. Oh, go ahead, Bruce.
Well, I would also say I agree with that completely. And my paper touches on that we need these general principles. And I reject in my paper the broadest socializations of costs. And I say that we should try to pinpoint, you know, to the nearest degree possible who the beneficiaries are. That's not as easy as it sounds, right, because of the way power works. But correct me if I'm wrong, but FERC received over 100 sets of comments, I believe, in this request. So I think what that shows is that at least some of those might be workable solutions, that there are probably a number of good ideas out there. Rome's not built in a day. I think that if we just kind of take our time incrementally, we can find that solution that works. And as I say in my paper, find a way to encourage some developers to lay these wires and give them the certainty that they need to move forward.
Yeah, I don't hear anybody on our panel saying there's only one way that costs should be recovered for building this national transmission grid. The most unusual way is the centerpiece of Gibbs' paper on congestion pricing. But you're not rejecting cost allocation or socialization of costs either. The distinction I'm hearing between Ashley Brown and Mark Robbins, however, in response to the question is, Mark, you're saying, yeah, I understand the regulators are stepping in because there's a vacuum. But really, you think that this is the work of the Congress and they ought to get on it?
My experience has been, going back on a number of issues, is when FERC gets in front of the Senate Energy Committee on an issue like this, it never works out well for FERC in the long run.
But that I agree with. The problem is...
But do it anyway.
The problem is, if you took total knowledge in the U.S. Congress about these issues... You'd have a lot of room left in the
thimble. No, wait a minute. We may. With apologies to the congressional staff that's in the room. Right?
Okay. And one last thing, Howard, I would completely agree with Ashley that even if you did, were able to find a solution that worked, it may not be working in 2 years. And I say this in the paper that these cost allocations need to be reassessed, and you have to update them over time and not just set it and forget it like a crock pot, you know?
All right, let's get the audience in for a couple more before lunch. Any other... yes, sir, right in front here. Wait for the microphone, if you would. And if you don't mind identifying yourself. Okay, well, you're next.
Can I go?
Yeah, you sure can.
Okay, great. My name is Cindy Flynn. I'm with a company called CEF Marketing. And my question is directed primarily to you, Mark. I thought you made a very provocative statement early on about how this national grid had to be supported by the federal government. Or by the legislators, excuse me. And one of my concerns, since I'm in marketing and communications and increasingly doing more work in the energy field, is the whole idea of consumer input. For me, I'm just learning about this whole national grid concept, and I'm wondering if any efforts have been made by organizations to educate consumers as to why this is important. This is, to me, it's fairly obvious that legislators listen to their constituents, so I would like to hear more about that.
Right. We're trying to do our part at the Manhattan Institute. I would just point that out. Mark or anybody?
I was going to start with a plug as well for the Manhattan Institute. I think certainly people that are interested in building transmission lines in this country are expending resources to try to make sure that broadly the public is aware in areas that might be affected. And really the siting culture that has to be developed to allow for this to happen goes to, I think, three areas, if I can remember them. One is that economic interdependence that exists. You know, if you're sitting in a state and you think, what am I getting out of this? Well, you're getting a healthy economy that we all benefit from, even if you aren't getting a particular electron off of a thing. You also have to develop an understanding of folks that large energy infrastructure is not built for the moment. It's built for what may happen in the next 50 years, and nobody can guarantee that. But if you're looking for a guarantee that major energy infrastructure is needed right now, the only thing you're guaranteed is that it won't be there when you actually do need it. So you have to develop that understanding of the time frame associated with infrastructure. And the last is something that I used to call intergenerational dependence. You know, that's not the right word, but it's actually the Eisenhower effect. You have to develop an understanding that things were built that we derive the benefits from now 50 years ago, and that what we're building now isn't for the individual who's affected right now, but it's actually for the generations that come after us that will take advantage of these major energy infrastructure expenditures that are in the tens of billions of dollars at times. And if those three things can be expressed to people, I think you have an opportunity to get the message across and allow some of these projects to be built.
Another quick add-on question here.
Okay, make it quick.
So are any of the utilities actually communicating this to their customers?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Right. I assume that, by the way, the construction of transmission lines is a relatively labor-intensive enterprise that puts people to work.
Well, there's individuals here like MAEP that would have a much better feel for that than I do, but
right,
yes.
But just pointing that out. Yes, sir, the patient gentleman in the front row here.
I'm Terry Hill with the Passive House Institute. I've got a question about DC lines and the role that might play in alleviating the NIMBY. Is that possible that direct current lines would help?
You're talking about a diminished environmental effect of direct current.
Yeah.
Right.
Being able to bury them.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh, buried lines are a different issue. I mean, if you're willing to pay for buried lines, you may get rid of some of the environment. Not all of them. You get rid of some of it. But you got it. That's an enormous, I don't know what the magnitude is, but that's an enormous increase in the cost of the line. So the question is, how much are we willing to pay for that benefit?
Right, but it might alleviate some of the siting resistance.
It might.
Well, there is also an issue of the distance you're talking about with a buried line versus an above ground line and how practical it is or feasible it is to put a DC line in. The DC lines that I'm familiar with that people are engaged in now trying to get off the ground, none of them involve significant segments that are buried. So you basically have the same type of environmental effects with a DC line you have with an AC line, plus you have the converter stations that you have to impose. Some of those are pretty large.
Well, and the DC-AC question and underground, overground are not necessarily the same. They're different questions.
Yeah.
You have the same issue with whatever kind of line it is.
Was there some reason you thought DC was more acceptable?
No, I'm just thinking about what Europe's proposing to, you know, site their solar in Egypt and take it across the water.
Yeah, that's a point-to-point, more of a point-to-point issue. You've got something here and you want to deliver it intact, basically, way over here.
Okay, well, I think we ought to thank our participants. We're going to break for lunch. Yes, thank our participants.
I think it is clear how fortunate we are
to believe in the power of ideas.
Supply the common sense and the fresh thinking of the Manhattan Institute.